Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Thanks for tuning in this week. We have several guests this evening, and we'll cover a variety of topics ranging from a new pedal system to cycling the Great Divide. We'll throw in a little San Francisco Bike Expo this week so as not to have the earth tilt too far east after talking about the Philly Bike Expo last week. First, I'd like to let you know that the Kickstarter project for the Bike Shifter for Anybody, by Anybody from OneStreet.org was successfully funded last week, and Sue Knapp thanks everyone who believed in her project for helping make it a reality. Also, when we spoke with Wall Street Journal reporter Reed Albergati, who co-authored the book Wheelman, we mentioned the fact that Bay Area investment banker Tom Wiesel might be complicit in helping to cover up Armstrong's positive doping test way back when they concocted the idea to backdate a prescription for a saddle cream. This week, Nathaniel Vinton of the New York Daily News published an article titled Lance Armstrong's Investors Helped Cover Up Doping as Early as 99, and then affidavit. In that article, the affidavit by Emma O'Reilly, who was vilified and humiliated by Armstrong, swears that she was present when Mr. Wiesel and Mark Gorski attended a meeting when the tainted sample was discussed. That affidavit was published last year, but the names of Wiesel and Gorski were redacted. Now they may no longer be able to escape legal prosecution as the indictments in the whistleblower suit go forward. As always, like those who can't look away from terrifying scenes, we'll keep watching. So let's get on with the show this week. My first guests are Dr. Ken Sparks and inventor Nick Stevovich. More than 20 years ago, Nick was doing some bike racing when he realized that his legs hurt a lot more riding his bike than they did when he was inline skating or skiing. As sometimes happens, a light bulb went off in his head and he drew the first rough picture of what was to become a new idea in pedal design. Dr. Sparks is the director of the Human Performance Laboratory at Cleveland State University right here in downtown Cleveland. He also directs the faculty staff Fitness for Life program on campus and has been the project administrator for the National Youth Sports Program. Along with a small team of designers and engineers, the first prototypes for their truly new pedal system is in testing, and we'll talk with them about what is so new and so different about it, why it might be a better system than the pedals we now use, and when it might be coming to market. We'll talk then with Philip Segura from San Francisco Bike Expo as he scurries around putting the finishing touches on the event for next weekend. And we'll head on out to the Grand Tetons to talk with writer and adventurer Michael Mac McCoy. Back in 2000, Mac authored Cycling the Great Divide, considered the Great Divide Route Rider's Bible. Recently, the updated second edition came off the presses, and we'll talk with Mac about what is so compelling about our Great Divide and how to prepare to ride this epic trail. So here we go, and not very far. Downtown Cleveland, Dr. Ken Sparks and Nick Stevovich are right here to talk with us. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I'd like to get each of you to tell me a little bit about yourselves and your work. Nick, why don't you tell us about your background and how you came up with the new pedal idea?
Sure. The idea started almost 20 years ago when I was doing amateur races, and you know, I go enter the races and found myself to be a pretty mediocre cyclist. Still had a lot of fun, and you think back in the 90s, rollerblading was big at the same time, and I'd go rollerblade for a period of time, and you know, after my rollerblading, I thought, gee, that's interesting. My legs feel different than when I cycle, so I started coming up with some theories that is, if I could incorporate more muscles into my legs while cycling, I should get more output. So I essentially took the rollerblading motion and cycling motion and put it into one. And the way I did that, I was doodling with, you know, doing some drawings and trying to figure out, do I change the crank? Do I change the bottom bracket? Do I change the frame? and ended up with the pedal. Said, okay, we could do that motion in the pedal. So that's how I started this now almost 20 years ago. And the story keeps evolving as how I met Ken and prototypes made and where we are here today.
So that kind of leads us right over to Ken. And among the great topics that are listed as your area of teaching are mechanical analysis of human movement and ergonomics, which obviously sort of dovetails with what Nick is doing. Do you work with a lot of cyclists as well as runners, Ken?
Yes, we do. We have several studies going, right now, but we work with not only runners of track caliber, but we also do ultramarathoners, and we have cyclists. We do a lot of testing with Ironmen. So we have a variety. It's all based on performance and trying to improve their performance through either different training techniques or recovery or something like this.
I didn't realize there was a human performance lab at Cleveland State.
Yes, we're located right in the physical education building, and our lab's about 8,000 square feet, makes up about six different rooms. We have an environmental chamber that we can test under severe conditions. We can go down to freezing and up to about 130 degrees, and we have we can simulate altitude. We can go up as high as 25,000 feet in the lab.
That's a lot of extremes.
You know, it's funny, Diane, real quick story. When I met Ken, my first path of testing this was through a consultant who advised me. He said, Nick, you need to go to the Boulder Sports and Medicine Facility, and they're the world mecca of testing for cyclists and runners. So I started down this path, and through a relationship with my engineers, I met Ken, and he said, well, Ken does a lot of studies. You should ask him. So Ken may not remember this, but I showed him the studies that for this Boulder Sports and Medicine Facility was going to do. Are proposing, and Ken looked at the first couple, and he's like, well, we could do this here, and we do this here, and we got halfway down the list. He's like, well, why would you go to Denver when you do it right here in Cleveland, Ohio? And I said, exactly. So I think the lab is just one of those secrets, the best-kept secrets.
It must be, because this is the first I've heard of it, and that's what everybody does. They'll either go to Texas to, and I don't remember the name of the lab down there, or out to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, or out to California. And here we have this wonderful testing facility. Do you guys have any relationship with, say, Cleveland Clinic or UH Sports Medicine?
I do work with, I've got a study going right now with the Cleveland Clinic. I do a lot of work for industry. We have work that we're doing with Scott Care Corporation that makes cardiovascular testing equipment. We have going with Orbital Research, which is right down the street from us, and working on several projects with the military. So it's we have a variety of things going on in the lab right now.
Yeah, I wonder how you have any time to teach, but evidently you do that too, huh?
Well, I teach in the graduate school, and my classes are in the evening. So I have all day to do the research.
Well, let's get back to this pedal. Can you explain how the pedal changes the mechanics of either the foot or the leg and what you believe are the benefits of this new system? And then we'll kind of get into the nitty-gritty of the pedal with, the engineering of it.
Okay. Well, the pedal, on the downstroke of the pedal, it really gives you a longer power stroke. So you're able to generate more power, and we found this to be true on most of our athletes that we tested, that they could generate more power with this, kind of a skating motion where the pedal moves outward. And it so we looked at the power output of the pedal, and we also looked at the efficiency, as if it was more efficient, so that we got more for the greater output of the pedal. Did the rider have to also put out more energy? And what we found on a lot of our cyclists, and we had like 50, most of them were triathletes that we were testing with this pedal, and we found out that they did they got more power output of the pedal at the same time they took less energy to produce that power output, so it was more efficient as well as increasing the power.
So the question that comes to mind for me is about position on the bike. Does the saddle height have to change either high or low or fore or aft? Do you have to make a change in your how you sit on the bike for this pedal system to work most efficiently?
No, it doesn't seem to make any difference on the, that position. They get into a normal position that they would ride. It's just it comes from the pedal itself.
Okay. Everybody can sort of visualize what a pedal looks like with a pedal spindle and whatever it is on the end that kind of turns, and then you'll clip into it and you just start pedaling. So what is different about the new pedal system?
So imagine you're at your foot is at the 12 o'clock position on the bike. So as you're pedaling forward and your foot is moving towards the 3 o'clock position, the pedal not only moves parallel to the bike, but it starts moving outward. And as you get to the 6 o'clock position, the pedal's at the outermost point away from the frame and at the 6 o'clock position. So imagine it goes out anywhere from, we can go as little as a quarter inch, you can go out as much as 1.5 inches. And that's some of the things we're testing to see what is the optimal distance. And then as you come up from the 6 o'clock to the 9 o'clock position, the pedal starts moving back in towards the frame. And when you reach the 12 o'clock position, it's in the standard position. It's always timed. So the rider doesn't have to make that pedal go in that direction. That's kind of our secret sauce, is how that pedal comes in and out at the same point. And, you know, it's essentially a sine curve. You think back to your math days of what a sine curve looks like. So the angle changes at every degree in the crank, and it's exactly correlated to the crank of the pedal. So again, the work is in the pedal. The rider doesn't have to do that work.
Wow. So this really is a totally new design. This is something completely different from anything we've ever seen. I mean, you know, I remember when we went from a toe clip and strap to the look binding style system. And then Speedplay, of course, came out with what we felt was a really good system for people with knee problems or hip problems or ankle problems. And now, I guess my next question goes to, will this take care of problems like knee problems, hip problems, back problems, you know, the kinds of things that, you know, I try to resolve these problems, but will this pedal resolve those problems because of the way it works?
I'm not sure it will resolve them. That's one of the things that we really want to look at, is especially in women with the different angle from their hips to their knees with the movement of the pedal to we want to look at more about the stress that might be either relieved or placed on the knee. So that's kind of something that we want to look at in the near future.
I'm speaking with Nick Stevovich and Dr. Ken Sparks. They have developed a new pedal system. I think it's called Motion Resolution, yes?
That's the name of the company, correct.
Okay, is that also the name of the pedal, or do you have a pet name for the pedal, like Speedplay has its X2, or Look has its, I don't even know what they have right now. I haven't looked in a while.
Well, it's funny, Diane, it's on my to-do list. I'm going to change the name of the company, or the name of the pedal hasn't been decided yet, but getting a website, name of the product, it's all on the to-do list to be determined in the next 30, 60 days.
So, Nick, I actually read an interview you did with some organization called High Velocity, and I noticed that you target the user as the athlete. So is the pedal not meant for, say, a recreational or touring cyclist? Is it specifically meant for the performance rider?
No, it is. It's meant for all. In fact, I would even class myself as a weekend warrior, that I don't ride anywhere near as much as I'd like to, and I don't race anymore. But it's, you know, one of the things that as I'm doing my research is, why couldn't this work for a commuter cyclist, someone who wants to get to work with a little bit more energy and have a fun experience getting to work with these pedals? It worked for triathletes and cyclists. In fact, the very first prototype, Diane, was just a flat platform pedal that I probably logged a couple thousand miles on it. So, and I put it on my Gary Fisher mountain bike and put it through the Metro Park. So it works on any pedal. So I think the premise of that article was we're looking at what market would likely adopt the technology first.
Okay.
And I think that's what we're doing with that.
Yeah, it's always top down. That's true. You know, you always go for your performance and it trickles down, hopefully, at least with most of the performance products. I have a question about the interface between the pedal and the foot. Will there be an actual cleat or do you just place your foot on the pedal? Obviously, you want to be able to pull as well as push, right?
Right. It's actually, the pedal's made so that you can use pretty much any clip that's out there on the market. It fits right into the pedal, so you wouldn't have to change your clips or anything.
Oh, my. My visual just went right out the window. The whole idea that I had about this pedal just was like, oh, it's going to have all new everything. So there is nothing proprietary about the cleat or the attachment of the pedal to the shoe. Very cool. Very, very cool.
Our prototypes, we have a look style prototype, which Dr. Sparks tested at Cleveland State. We also have a SPD style prototype that current studies going on at Kent State as well with that. So the technology is very transferable to essentially to any kind of pedal that the rider prefers.
So is the technology internal to the pedal?
Correct.
Aha!
It is.
Okay, now my visual just kind of settled back into where it probably needs to be. So you don't look at this pedal and say, oh, this pedal looks really, really revolutionary.
When you look at, especially our latest version is an SPD version, a quick glance, you wouldn't know the difference. So you see it in motion, you would notice it immediately then that, hey, that pedal is different. It looks different. So you know, one of the things we want to do is when I talk to potential customers, I always ask them, you know, what do you like about it? What works well? But also, equally important, I ask, why not? Why wouldn't you buy this? What do you see as an issue? And there's various things like from safety, does it work? Is it going to last? The aesthetics of the pedal. So we wanted to make sure we eliminate all the why nots before, as many of the why nots before we go to market. So that's why a lot of research and a lot of we could transfer that technology to if you're an SPD-only person or if you're a look-style-only person. Speed play, the conversations have not happened yet, but you know that may be down the road.
So will there be more than one model of the pedal then? I mean, in terms of price points, and we don't need to talk about price. That's not relevant. But will there, for example, be a recreational model that might be a little bit heavier and a little less expensive and going up into the competition model that might be a little bit lighter and a little bit more expensive?
Initially, we're going to launch with a single product, probably have a look and an SPD version of it. But exactly that, Diane, we will expand into the commuter cyclist to a higher end, someone who's going to pay for the lighter material to the commuter who's not worried about weight, the heavy duty material. So as we grow, the company will continue to introduce different versions of the technology.
So, Ken, I want to ask you if there are a couple of other mechanical advantages that you see. Do you see any limitations with this pedal, places where it's not going to be useful? Are there specific riders, for example, who wouldn't benefit from this?
Well, in all the riders that we tested the pedal on, the data that we got was actually better on the men than it was on the women, but we're going back and looking at why it wasn't better on the women. And they, you know, some of them did very, very well with it, but the men seem to benefit much more, generating power as well as increasing their efficiency. So it could be something with the angle of their knees and with how it works. So we're going to go back and look at that mechanical motion to see what that difference is.
Interesting. Did it have anything to do you think, with the size of the woman, the height or the weight or the type of riding? Were people tested in aero bars, for example, or with upright style, you know, 10-speed, you know, regular bars?
Yeah, this was the test was all on a Velotron bicycle, which is really a test bike that we can measure power, and we can actually see in the total stroke where a person's losing power. And that's something we want to look at, because we had riders that were, you know, 5'2", and we had riders that were 6'2", that were women. And it We at that point we were just looking strictly at the pedal and the power output of the pedal and the efficiency of using the pedal, and we really didn't look at the mechanics of the rider himself. So it could very well be something with the height of the cyclist.
So that brings me toward kind of starting to wind it down a little bit, and that is, when do you think you'll have prototypes? Well, I guess prototypes you already have. When will you already have working prototypes that you're going to actually come to the point of saying, okay, this is something that's ready to go to market? Do you have a target date?
I do. I've been working with my lead engineer, Dave Pearson, that we've got about a dozen working prototypes right now that we're testing. The next phase of this is to build 100 prototypes. And we wanted to give them to select riders. These are professional cyclists. These are professional coaches, trainers, folks like Dr. Sparks, product testers, and get the empirical anecdotal data from some cyclists and what works, what's not working. We anticipate having this done, Diane, that next phase, starting here in the next 30 to 60 days, with pedals in hands of riders by February of next year.
Okay.
And getting them a chance, a month or two to ride. And targeting mid next year to be able to manufacture and sell the pedals.
So the manufacturing will be stateside or abroad, do you think?
I think a split. There's certain parts that we don't need to re-engineer. You know, the clip on your shoe, there's no sense us figuring out how to do that when I could just go, we could buy the SPD or the looks of the clip that goes on the bottom of the shoe. But certain parts I'll call the proprietary portions of the pedal we like to make here in the United States, specifically like to make in the Cleveland area.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Wow. So will you be able to be putting up or will you be putting up some sort of video that people can start to watch how these things work? I sort of have this visual now. And the questions that come up for me still have to do, and this is for Ken, with hips and legs and sort of that sacral area, that pelvic area of the body. As you know, I know skating seems to work. So I've never tried skating or skate skiing or anything like that. But I'm wondering if that's going to translate into cycling, and evidently you think it will.
I think it can. I think there's some, a little bit of an advantage. You know, if it's as little as 1 or 2%, that can be very significant over, say, a 100-mile bike ride in terms of saving the efficiency and saving that much energy. And the power output, we're looking at maybe as much as 100, 150 watts going up a hill. That's significant when it comes to some courses that are climb courses.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. We obviously are going to be watching this because there hasn't been a lot of new technology in pedals. Now, of course, we have all the electronic stuff going on with shifting, and that's relatively new. But when we're talking about actually changing the motion of pedaling the bike, that's brand new. And I'm going to want to really watch it carefully. I think it's very cool. I hope it works out because I love seeing new things happen right here in Northeast Ohio, too. Well, you'll stay in touch, yes?
Yes, we will. And we'll have a website up and running here soon. And there's videos that we can upload of the test, what the pedal looks like, how the animation of it works. So coming soon to a theater near you.
Well, as soon as you do that, we'll post it on our Facebook page. And I want to thank you both. I know you're both busy. You actually work across the street from one another. Thank you so much for taking time today to talk with me on The Outspoken Cyclist, the new pedal resolution. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Ken. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Ken Sparks and Nick Stevovich join me from Nick's offices in downtown Cleveland. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Friday, November 15th, you can help support those in need at the Hospice of the Western Reserve Warehouse Sale, taking place from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Featuring quality used furniture, accessory pieces, antiques, collectibles, and decorative items, proceeds from this sale benefit patients in need throughout our area. Parking for the warehouse sale is available in the Hospice of the Western Reserve parking lot at 17876 St. Clair Avenue in Cleveland. Follow the warehouse sale signs on arrival. More information at hospicewr.org.
This entire piece of music was played with only two instruments, a right hand and a left hand. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life with hands-only CPR. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands-only CPR is recommended by the American Heart Association, and it's incredibly easy and effective. Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. The power to help save a life is in your hands. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Diane Lees, and we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are going to head out to San Francisco to have a short discussion with Philip Segura about the San Francisco Bike Expo, which is taking place November 16th, a week from today. Hi, Philip. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time out of your crazy busy schedule to talk with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So next Saturday, November 16th, is the 6th annual San Francisco Bike Expo. I wanted to let those in the Bay Area and from surrounding areas know a bit more about it. So let's go through the basic statistics. Where is it being held?
It's actually being held at the Cow Palace, which sits right outside San Francisco in Daly City, California. It's an old venue. It's an old historic venue. The Pope, John F. Kennedy, Metallica have all been there, and every year for the last 6 years, we've turned the Cow Palace into the Bike Palace.
You know, I've heard of the Cow Palace. I've never been there. I think it's such a cool name. I love it. It must hail back to a long time in the last century, but it's cool to know that Metallica was there too. Of course, we've got the Pope and ex-president, but I just honed right in on the Metallica thing. So what kind of events are you going to have at this Bike Expo? I know the swap meet is a big one, but you have other things going on too.
We've got a handful of things this year. We've got a couple of group rides. You know, in the past, we've actually had we've had a fashion show and a dirt jumping competition. But this year, we're kind of going to get back to our roots a little bit and focus on the actual vendors and the swap. We've got the handmade photo booth that Paul Silbeck and his team, they actually have a photo booth where you can get your photo taken or photo of your bike, your handmade bike made in the U.S. or abroad, or I should say in the U.S., but they're putting a studio together. They did it last year. They have a 20 by 20 footprint and all the professional photo studio lights and cameras and equipment, and they take a really nice photo of your handmade bicycle.
Well, how nice is that? That's kind of cool. So you can kind of frame it and put it up on your wall?
Yeah, you know how people, they're very passionate about their bikes.
So. Yes, I do. I absolutely do. So one of the things that I think is very cool about your event is admission is free.
Yes, admission is free this year. You know, we look at the expo as a big community event. We believe that all bikes are welcome, in San Francisco and San Jose and Oakland in the Bay Area, we have such a huge bicycling culture, I think I've always challenged folks to think about, when you started riding a bicycle and think about products that you can, that you started on, or hobbies or passions that you start at such a young age, but still carries throughout your lifetime. You know, it's fascinating. I think most people will agree that ride bicycles, it's probably the coolest and funnest and most practical invention ever made. I can, for those listening out there, think about what's out there that really, starts at such a young age and just really carries through your lifetime. And, free is a nice thing for the community, for the Bay Area. We've got a lot of vendors that come from all over the country, and you know, want to shine at the with the Bay Area cyclists. So it's always always great to offer something to the community like that.
So it's basically funded by the exhibitors.
Yes.
Okay. Very
exhibitors
cool.
And the sponsors, and right. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, a great local event that's, you know, now in its our sixth year.
How many people do you think will come into the venue? It's only one day, right?
It's only one day this year. We've had on average about 5,000 people, and that's
wow.
like a paid show. So opening up to a free show should hopefully let down some of those barriers or some of those skeptics to just come and, you know, enjoy and see what the cycling industry has to offer.
So let's go over the date, the time, the location, and the website for everybody. It's next Saturday, November 16th?
Yep, Saturday, November 16th.
And when does it open? What time does it open?
Doors open at 11 o'clock. We go till 6 o'clock. There is free bike parking available indoors.
Cool.
You know, we'll have a lot of local shops in attendance that will be selling some closeouts. We've got also a lot of vendors. Actually, very proud that we have a lot of U.S.-made vendors that will be in attendance, U.S. manufacturers and small to medium manufacturers and services that will be in attendance. You know, we kind of think of the Bike Expo as a great platform for these vendors, you know, that can't get to Interbike, you
right.
know, that don't have the means just yet. You know, you sort of need that intermediary small step to get to the next step.
Absolutely.
Feel the Bike Expos, you know, like Portland, the Pedal Nation folks, Philly Bike Expo, Seattle Bike Expo, you know, are all important. Every city, every major city or any city should really have some sort of bike festival, bike expo to, you know, get the community together. You know, we're helping build a bike park right next to the San Francisco's first bike park, next to the Cow Palace, McLaren Park. So we're raising money for that. The folks over at the Flow Trail, they're over in Fairfax have built a really awesome trail, and they're looking to build another one. So they're looking for support there. So there's just a lot of great aspects when everybody comes together at these expos.
And so it's at the Cow Palace. And is there a website people can go take a look?
Absolutely. sfbikeexpo.com. They could follow us on Facebook, SF Bike Expo, and Instagram. So
you're social media, you know, times three. That's awesome.
We've got to. We're in San Francisco.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day getting ready for the San Francisco Bike Expo. And good luck next week.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a great day. Have a great night.
Bye.
Philip Segura, who is the director of the San Francisco Bike Expo, joined me from his office in San Francisco. I always wanted to know what the Cow Palace was like, so maybe next time I'm out that way, I'll go take a look. So now we're going to head on out to Teton Valley, Idaho. Sounds like such a cool place to be. We're going to talk with Michael, better known as Mac, McCoy. He is the author of the original Cycling the Great Divide, and the second edition has just been released on Mountaineer's Books, Cycling the Great Divide from Canada to Mexico on North America's premier long-distance mountain bike route. Mac, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
It's my pleasure. So you were one of the early cross-country riders during the bike centennial days, making your first trip in 1974. My first question is, have you seen a lot of changes in the kind of touring that you did then compared to what you see today?
Well, I think the kind of touring hasn't changed that much. The equipment certainly hasn't. And, you know, we were... I'll tell you about the trip later. It was with my future wife, but we were not experienced cyclists, so we were learning as we went. And of course, back then, it was a phone call to the parents once a week, and that was about the extent of your communications. But people now are so well connected when they're out touring with their blogs and their texting and everything. So that's a big difference. We actually worked our way across the country. We didn't end up going all the way across the country. That was our plan, but we ended up going from Seattle to northeast Wisconsin, where we ran out of time. And one reason we ran out of time was because we were working our way across, getting odd jobs like cleaning Safeway windows and painting curbs yellow in Belle-Fou, South Dakota for the 4th of July celebration, things like that.
Wow. How old were you guys when you made that trip?
I was 23. Nancy was... 19 or 20.
Huh.
I had met her the previous winter when we were both working at Grand Targhee Ski Resort in Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, we came up with the idea of a bike trip after we'd gotten tired of the snow. There was a lot of snow that winter, and we were browsing through an REI catalog. Said, that bike tour sounds like a good idea. Let's try it. So we called Redmond Cyclery in Redmond, Washington, close to where she was from in Bellevue, and ordered up two bikes. And after a 30-mile shakedown ride around Lake Sammamish, we were good to go.
That was it, 30 miles, huh?
That was it. Our legs were strong from skiing, but other than that, right. Our bums weren't exactly in shape for riding.
So these were basically steel touring bikes.
Yeah, they were Peugeot U08s, off the rack 10 speeds.
Wow.
If I remember correctly, they were $130 each.
And they probably had really narrow gearing compared to today.
They did. Looking back on it, we didn't have adequate gearing for some of the mountain passes we went over.
Yeah, but you were young and stupid, right?
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. We went into Seattle and got some primitive panniers at a place called Sportscaster. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was a one-piece unit with panniers hanging down on both sides of a rear rack, and
right.
a compartment above that the sleeping bags were stuffed into, so it was all one piece, and everything was on the back. So we didn't have wheels that were up to that rear wheel was up to that either. So we broke a lot of spokes and learned how to change spokes along the way.
So how did that trip then lead you to working with Adventure Cycling? And you've pretty much been working with them since 1976.
Yep, that's right. Uh-huh. There have been a few breaks in there, but working with Adventure Cycling pretty solid since then. When we were overnighting in Deer Lodge, Montana, a cyclist pulled up. This is on our ride. A cyclist pulled up and told us he was the local liaison for a grassroots group known as Bike Centennial, which was planning a huge cross-country ride for the 1976 American Bicentennial. And he gave us the address for the contacts in Missoula, the town we had ridden through just one or two days before getting to Deer Lodge. But we did not hear about Bike Centennial there. It was in Deer Lodge that we learned about it. After our tour ended later that summer, I wrote to Disciples and Burdens, the Bike Centennial founders, and told them that Nancy and I were interested in the project and available to work with them if they had a place for us. One thing led to another, and she and I joined the staff of Bike Centennial in December 1975. Our first duty was to drive the western half of the Transamerica Trail, setting up the overnight accommodations that we called bike-ins during that summer.
Right.
And then during the actual summer of 76, we served as the Oregon-Idaho field team, coordinating activities between the Missoula office and the leaders, groups, and trailheads in those states.
Wow, and it certainly has grown into an amazing organization since those days. Just amazing.
Yeah, that it's funny to think that, as far as I know, nobody thought it was going to continue being an organization. They thought it was just going to be a one-time event. But but it took on a life of its own, and you know, people hearing stories from those who came back from 76 or reading stories in magazines wanted their own shot at cycling across America, and that just helped Bike Centennial keep going, which of course changed its name to Adventure Cycling Association in the early 90s.
Yeah, that makes more sense, actually. So you actually do wear and have worn a bunch of different hats at AC. We're going to talk about your new book, the second edition of Cycling the Great Divide, but you also manage bikeovernights.org, and there seems to be a lot of sort of interest in this short, like 24-hour go on vacation idea. So explain the blog or the site bikeovernights.org, what it does and how you sort of facilitate it.
Sure. Just to back up a little bit, the mission, as most of your listeners probably know, the mission of Adventure Cycling Association is to inspire and empower people to travel by bicycle.
Right.
And not necessarily travel cross country or ride for weeks at a time, but just travel by bicycle. The neophytes have to begin somewhere, and even time-restricted veterans want to get out now and then. So bikeovernights.org is basically a website. It's a program. We call it a program, but the website is the meat of it. Bikeovernights.org provides inspiration, resources, and tools for short 1 to 2 night overnight bicycle adventures. We do this primarily by posting at the website firsthand accounts of stories and photos by contributors. Since launching the site in early 2011, I believe, we have published around 150 such stories. And the tagline up the site kind of says it all. It's a don't wait to go cross country, go overnight.
Right. Well, I had to go out to the site and take a look around, and of course I'd have to look at Ohio, and I don't remember the guy's name who posted the Ohio information, but the one in Ohio is the Little Miami Trail, which in fact we just did two sections of last month. So it is really cool to just get out there, get on your bike and ride some of these trails or just, you know, get away for a couple of days or a day. So that's really, really cool. So are you encouraging people to send information to bikeovernights.org? Are you actively soliciting, you know, these kinds of trips from people?
Yeah, absolutely we are. If you go to the site, bikeovernights.org, you'll find a submit a trip button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, and it gives instructions on how to do it. And yes, we want to get as many as we can. Speaking of Ohio, I'm surprised we haven't had more from there because it's such a bicycling state. But I think we did. Did we have what? Just a couple from Ohio?
When I looked just yesterday, there was only one posted, I can believe that. We get out and ride, but we may not be very literate about getting the information back to you. But you know what? Maybe they'll be more encouraged to do that because there are a lot of really nice rides in Ohio. Really nice and short. Yeah. You can just leave one day and come back the next.
Well, I hope that they do, and you probably know that the roots of Bicentennial are in Ohio, that both of the couples that started the organization came from Columbus.
Right, and there's also the Underground Railroad, you know, which expands through here. Yeah, so there are several. I'm talking with Michael Mack McCoy. His new book is the second edition of the Cycling the Great Divide. Mack works with Adventure Cyclist and bikeovernights.org, and I would like to talk about your new book. The subtitle states that the ride is, quote, from Canada to Mexico, a North America's premier long-distance mountain bike route. So what is the actual distance from start to finish?
It's the route goes from Banff, Alberta, to Antelope Wells, New Mexico, at the Mexico border. And that's, at last count, we have little changes in the route now and then, but right now it measures 2,774 miles.
Wow. Wow. And I noticed that the book actually covers about 70 days. So obviously, either you have to take that kind of time, that's a little over 2 months, or do you have it so that you can kind of break it up into, let's start in Banff and then go X, and then next you'll do the next year and go Y and Z. Do you know what I mean?
The maps in the book, actually the book is meant to accompany the maps that are sold by Adventure Cycling Association, and the maps that Adventure Cycling sells are much more detailed than the maps in the books because of the constraints of page size.
Right.
So the book provides a lot of information that there was not room to put on the maps, and vice versa, the maps cover show you how to navigate on the trail much better. And those maps that Adventure Cycling sells are broken into 7 sections, and a lot of times people will buy just one section and do all or part of that section, and maybe over time piece the whole thing together.
So got it.
Yeah,
that makes good sense, actually. So the word premier always interests me. Does that mean it's the best, or does that translate into, yeah, this is really difficult?
It doesn't mean difficult necessarily. I actually think the publisher, which is the Mountaineers Books of Seattle, came up with that subtitle.
Okay.
It's the way we usually describe it is the world's longest mountain bike route and the longest and best known off-pavement touring route in North America. So I suppose that makes it premier. Riding it is more difficult than road touring, but the route sticks mostly to graded gravel and dirt roads, so it's generally not as difficult as riding single-track trails would be. In fact, that was one of our criteria when planning the route, was to try to avoid mostly mountain single tracks, because those can be really hard to ride while carrying or pulling gear.
So, okay, that was my next question. So are we using suspension, front and rear suspension, or just front suspension?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Some of the there are some bikes being made nowadays, especially for this kind of riding. Note the Salsa Fargo 29er and
right.
The Co-Motion Divide 29er. Those, you can get those without any suspension because they roll over things so well. But if you're using a traditional 26-inch or even the mid-size 650B
right.
Bike, I would go with suspension. I've gone with full suspension on every ride I have taken on the route, and I'm glad that I did. The main reason being, especially later in the summer or in particularly dry summers, you can get a lot of washboard conditions on some of these gravel roads, and that can be really, really miserable if you don't have suspension.
Do most people bring a trailer, or most people use panniers?
It's a little bit of both. I don't know if I can say what most, you know,
okay.
What, is more popular than the other. But then there's a third option now that's gaining popularity, and that's the lightweight bike packing frame packs. And people are you know, they're learning that you don't have to have 40 pounds of gear. You can have maybe 15 or 20 pounds. And like the Diamond, you know, you've seen the frame packs go inside the Diamond.
Right.
Your,
right.
Backpack, yeah, and handlebars are mounted, sleeping bags, things like that. So there's some really creative packing things happening right now. It's kind of exciting to see.
How many people do you think actually participate over, let's say, over one season? When would the Banff start open for the season? Obviously, you're not going to start in January.
Yeah, that's right. There's a race you've probably heard of called the Tour Divide.
Oh, yeah.
That covers the route, and they start usually right around the 10th of June, which is too early. They often get into snow, really miserable snowy passes that they have to walk miles through the snow. So I think July, you know, every year is different, the snowpack, but on a rule of thumb, I would say you wouldn't want to start before July 1st in Banff.
Aha, I see. Okay,
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
On the other hand, there are other parts of the route that you can ride earlier than that, just not the Canadian Rockies.
Yeah, the southern part of the ride. Yeah, sure, because down into areas like New Mexico, and it's warm down there. So I wanted to ask also about the inherent risks. So obviously, bicycling itself has inherent risks. Is there anything about the Great Divide route that is perhaps more risky than other mountain bike rides?
Probably the remoteness of certain sections is the biggest factor. There are three or four stretches of ranging from 125 to 225 miles that lack services and are even low on water sources. So riders need to be ultra prepared and aware of where these are and be ready for them and not set out on these rides on a lark. You know that the riding, as I pointed out earlier, the riding is not technical and not as difficult as some single tracks can be, but the remoteness is what is a big factor, and a lot of people, well, most people aren't prepared for it, but some people haven't been. They've been surprised by it. Oh, and then, of course, there's the grizzly bears. That's just a minor matter. from Banff to northwest Wyoming, there's a chance of encountering grizzly bears. As far as I know, nobody has been confronted or hurt by one in the 15 years that we've been doing the route. So something to be aware of, and hang your food at night out of the reach of bears and keep a clean camp and just follow the bear aware procedures that the Forest Service and other land management agencies tell you to do.
I'd be more afraid of snakes and spiders personally.
Yeah, well, that really isn't much of a concern. You're at high elevations until you get to southern New Mexico, and there are
true.
scorpions and rattlesnakes and stuff down there, but overall that's very, very much not a concern.
Well, maybe it's not so bad then. Okay, so if you have it divided up into so many sections, seven sections, evidently there are some campground facilities. Are there places where there are no campground facilities at all?
Yeah, even though the route is really wild, those remote sections are the exception, and you could stay in the town most nights if you wanted to, even in a motel, but most people don't. But most people don't stay in the towns, and they camp, and it's mostly primitive camping at established Forest Service campgrounds or wild camping like you're describing on Forest Service and BLM lands. The majority of the route is on those kinds of land, and on them people can camp pretty much anywhere they want to that's not signed, you know, no camping.
Right. Right.
We point out places in the book, obviously, because some places are just going to be nicer to camp than at others.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah.
If we were to say the Great Divide ride is a little bit different, the route is different, are there different items that people on this ride would need to carry that they might not have to carry on other trips? What kinds of,
I think you definitely want to carry a water filter. You need to think a little bit more like a backpacker than a bicycle tourist. In general, there's plenty of surface water along the route, but you don't want to drink that unless it's been treated with a water filter. So you want to carry a portable water filter, bear spray, is something we recommend carrying. Probably a few more tools along with the knowledge to use them than you'd carry for a road tour, and fairly extensive first aid supplies. And I'd say also, if you're so inclined, carry a fishing rod, because especially the northern half of the route encounters some of the best fly fishing streams in the West.
Yeah, you have to know how to use them.
Yeah, tools and the fishing rod.
That's exactly. So one of my last questions, although I'm going to have one that has nothing to do with the book towards the end here. Do you have a favorite section of the Great Divide Ride, one that just blows you away when you do it, or that did blow you away when you did it?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this over the years, because I've been asked that question a lot, and I really don't, but I have several favorites, and I'll name those if you want to hear them.
Sure.
There are five or six. I mean, the whole thing is really good, but these sections do stand out in my mind as being especially good. The entire Canada section from Banff, Alberta to Eureka, Montana would be one. Another one would be Southwest Montana, Bannock Ghost Town, through the Big Sheep Creek Backcountry Byway to the Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge. That's just spectacular. And then pretty remote and unpopulated part of the state, but we're just amazing country. Then I really like Togedee Pass to Pinedale, Wyoming. That goes over Union Pass and comes out in the upper Green River drainage, which is north of Pinedale. That's another beautiful section. And another section in Wyoming I like is South Pass City to Rawlins. That's through the high and dry Red Desert and Great Divide Basin. So there's from the moment you leave Atlantic City, which is near South Pass City, you literally do not see another tree growing for the next 130 miles.
But wow,
it's just a spectacular open wide country with pronghorn antelope and wild horses, and you're crossing historic trails like the Oregon Trail and the California Pony Express Trail. There's markers for those out there, and you can actually see ruts remaining from the emigrant trails from 150 years ago. Steamboat Springs to Salida, Colorado I'd recommend. That would be a good one for somebody to do if they wanted to do a first trip on it, because it's a little bit more settled as far as the number of towns go, and the terrain might be a little bit easier than some of these other sections. And finally, Dillon, North Colorado to Abiquiu, New Mexico. That's through southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. That's just spectacular.
It sounds to me like, even though it's divided into seven sections, you're taking something from several of the different sections and saying, okay, this is this part. So how long are these sections?
Let's see. I have to think about each one individually. They're different. Let's see. The Canada section that I mentioned, that's about 270 miles.
Okay. That gives me an idea of what you're,
what
you're saying.
Yeah, and they range from, that's probably the longest of the six sections I've mentioned, in the Togedee Pass to Pinedale, Wyoming is probably the shortest. That's just, maybe 120 miles, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though it sounds really remote and somewhat wild, it does sound exotic enough that as long as you can be comfortable on a mountain bike that many days, I think it would be a lot of fun. So my last question is actually not about the book and not about bikeovernights.org, but about your relationship with Adventure Cycling as an association right now. You happen to not be in Missoula, Montana. You actually live in the Grand Tetons. So so what is it, besides overseeing bikeovernights.org and writing this book, what else are you doing?
I do a lot of blogging for the organization, and I also do the Bike Bits e-newsletter, which goes out twice monthly. You're probably familiar with that.
Yes, I am.
And that actually takes quite a bit of time to put that together. So basically, I do writing for both digital and for the magazine. That's my biggest role right now.
And do you have any trips planned for 2014?
For 2014, we're thinking of, we did a, in preparation for preparing the second edition of the Great Divide Guidebook, that the first edition, by the way, was published in 2000, so
right.
It was badly in need of an update, so 13 years old. In preparation for that, my wife and I organized a group and ended up being 12 people that rode the Canada section. The original publication did not have Canada, because that was added after the route was, after the book was published in 2000, but the original route just went from the U.S.-Canada border to the U.S.-Mexico border. So the 270-mile Canada section was added in about 2003.
Okay.
And we're thinking about organizing a similar group ride with van support for the section from Salida, Colorado, probably down to Abiquiu, pretty much one of these sections I mentioned to you above, you know, in the one of my favorite sections. So we'll probably do that.
And when would that be?
Probably the monsoon season in the Southwest, once you get down into southern Colorado and New Mexico, can be a problem. And that's generally July and August into September. So we don't know yet, but we'd probably do it either in June or late September.
Wow. Well, this has been a most fascinating conversation, and I learned a lot about the Great Divide. I did watch the movie, you know, with the race, and I have a customer who has been doing sections. Actually, I guess it's of the Continental Divide he's been doing sections, but to me it's similar in terms of that north-south kind of traversing the North America. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me, and I will keep watching. It is Cycling the Great Divide from Canada to Mexico on North America's premier long-distance mountain bike route. It's by Michael Mack McCoy, and it is put out by Mountaineers Books, and you can get it from Adventure Cycling Organization or Association. And thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome, Dan. Could I say one thing in closing?
Absolutely.
Okay. As I described or explained in the introduction to the book, we didn't really know if there was going to be a market for this kind of riding, bicycle touring off pavement. And it's been really successful. I think we've actually helped start a movement for the gravel grinders and the off pavement touring. And to sort of underscore that, in 2009, National Geographic Adventure magazine named the Great Divide Route the number one adventure in America on its list of the 50 best North American adventures. So that was gratifying to see that.
That's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome. Well, I think it sounds like a wonderful ride. I don't know if at my age I would do that. I feel like I may be getting too old to do that, but the country sounds so beautiful, and what a great way to see it. So good luck with the book. Have fun in whatever you're doing next season, and we'll talk again.
Okay, thanks a lot, Diane.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Michael Mack McCoy joined me from what sounds like heaven on earth, Grand Teton Valley in Idaho. The Great Divide sounds like a really interesting and magnificently expansive and beautiful ride. I'm not sure that I'm up to it, but I might be willing to at least entertain the idea of a short part of it. Just don't tell Brian. Well, anyway, thanks for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this week. It's been a pleasure, as always, to bring our show to you. I hope you have time for a ride if it's warm enough. If not, listen to more podcasts. We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.